Good afternoon. House Education Finance Committee will come to order. We've got a lot of members with competing schedule conflicts in a number of ways, but I think we've got enough to get started with a quorum. So if Representative Murphy, would you like to move the minutes? Get that out of the way?
Yes, Madam Chair, I'll move the minutes as printed.
Thank you. Any questions? All right, all in favor of approving the minutes, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? All right, minutes are adopted. Thank you, Representative Murphy. All right, Representative Drazkowski, why don't you, let's go ahead and get your bill before us, and we'll have some discussion and see if there's member questions on that. And I have a feeling we may have members coming in and out, so we'll just kind of do the best we can with this. But I will move House Bill 922, and the motion, we are going to move this bill or refer it to Tax Committee. And if you want to go ahead and explain your bill, I know we've got a couple of amendments as well.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. House File 922 endeavors to move the special elections that we have throughout statutes affecting counties, cities, and schools to one common date, and that date would be the first Tuesday after the first Monday in November, regardless of whether it was an even year general election year or if it was an odd year non-general election year. If it was an odd year non-general election year, of course, it would still be a special election, at least in most jurisdictions. Maybe some of them might have corresponding school board elections or city council elections that they might hold it in conjunction with. But absent that, it would be a special election those would be held on. And so I've got a variety of, we included most everything we could find in statute. We may have missed a few, and we intended, Madam Chair, to exclude, and I thought we're excluded, and I thought improperly we're excluded, two items dealing with mail voting for school referendums. And maybe Mr. Strom can talk more about these, and then statutory operating debt type situations. And so the A3 amendment aims to take those out, because I did intend those to be out as of the first time the bill was heard. So really that's all the bill does, is each of those special elections would be held on a common date. The advantage, of course, would be predictability, so that voters know when these special elections are. And also would help save local governments some cash. It would save money because they wouldn't have to hold those elections on a special date and pay for the costs associated with a special election if it was in an even year. Also, the other thing to consider, members, and another motivation for this bill is to help increase voter turnout for all of our elections, including these special elections in cities, counties, and schools. As we have heard, oftentimes many of these special elections bring with them 10 or 15% voter turnout. Of course, our November elections, at least those that happen on even years, garner anywhere from 80% in some of our rural areas. I know 90% voter turnout. So those are the two goals, three goals. Save money for local jurisdictions, increase voter turnout, and to bring predictability and understanding when the elections happen.
Thank you. Representative Mark Bright.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. And Representative Drazkowski, I strongly support your bill for all the reasons you just mentioned. I really like, in fact, I like your next bill, too. I can't imagine I'm saying I really agreeing with two of your bills right in a row there, Representative Drazkowski.
Can we adjourn, Madam
Chair? But no, that's exactly right. I mean, I know right now you can hold the school bond issues on any day. I think the operating referendums have to be in November, but I think the bond, it can be any time. And I agree, it saves costs, but more important, you get more voters there. And I had to congratulate my own superintendent because they're doing a school bond issue, and they're holding it in November. And I said, you know, you could have held that any time, but you're holding it there. And in Dilworth, we also are one of, I think, probably 100 out of the 800 and so many cities that have still the odd year election. So City of Dilworth will have an election too that day. So, I mean, it's the right way to go, because I think any time we do these major projects, we need to, it should be a predictable time, just as you're saying. And the more people we can get there, the better it is. So thank you, Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Representative.
So Representative Drazkowski, I think yours is the A3 amendment, which you discussed. I don't know, do you want to have Mr. Strom explain it? And I think maybe we should just add it to the bill to get the bill in the shape you'd like.
That would be great, Madam Chair.
Mr. Strom?
Madam Chair, Representative Drazkowski and members, if we could make one technical change to the amendment as well. The later amendment will amend the section that Representative Drazkowski amends out on line 1.2. So if that line instead would just read page 3, delete the new language in section 2, we'll momentarily have a section in the bill that doesn't have any statutory change in it, but then when the next amendment is offered, the two amendments would fit together then.
Okay.
So, Madam Chair, on 1.2, after delete, insert the words "the new language" in.
All right. Did everyone get that? And we are talking about the A3 amendment. So line 1.2 after page 3, delete, after the word delete, add "the new language" in.
Madam Chair, members, in terms of provisions that are contained in this amendment, as Representative Drazkowski said, under current law, the operating referendum has to be held in November unless there's a district in statutory operating debt. And if that's the case, then the commissioner can approve a second election during the year at any time. And also there's a mail ballot option. So what the amendment, the A3 amendment, does is restore those two options and makes clear that the operating referendum procedure is unchanged, that it's at November unless one of those two exceptions applies. As was mentioned earlier, for the debt elections, those can be at any date that otherwise does not conflict with a regular election date throughout the year. There's a schedule in statute of how close and how far away from the next nearest election they can be. So they can't be the day after the general election or a primary. They have to be a certain number of days before or after. But other than that schedule, they can be held at any time throughout the year.
Any questions on the amendment? All right, seeing none, all in favor of the A3 amendment with the oral technical amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? All right, the amendment's added. Thank you, Representative Drazkowski. And there is another amendment to the bill. I'm wondering, do you have any testifiers, or do we want to go?
I think there might be some testifiers, Madam Chair. I didn't bring any, but the bill may have attracted some.
Okay. All right. So. Okay. I think, well, why don't we just go ahead, since we have a good component of members here, and people are coming and going, we'll go ahead and do the next amendment, if that's all right with you. So in your packets, members, the A4 amendment, and this is one that actually I am offering. And the A4 amendment basically has to do with operating referendums. As you know, that over the past biennium, boards now have the ability to authorize some levy outside of voter approval from within their caps. And this amendment would basically state if they are going to the voters for additional voter-approved levy, that the any board-approved levy that they anticipate authorizing needs to be delineated on the ballot, so the voters are aware of the total amount of levy that that will be levied on their property taxes. So in total, so I look at it more as just a kind of a truth in taxation kind of issue, so people know exactly what they're voting on. And actually, my own district ran up against this a little bit with some confusion on the total amount of referendum levy authority that was being granted, because we had a referendum that failed one year and then came back with this new authority, and people were wondering why the amount was so much lower. And so, again, I think this is just a good public disclosure amendment. Any questions? Representative Drazkowski?
Thank you, Chair Loon. I support the amendment. I think it's an excellent amendment, and it's a responsible thing to share with the voters so that they have some transparency and understanding of what they're voting on.
Thank you. All right, so not seeing any questions, all in favor of the A4 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? All right, the A4 amendment's been added. Is there anyone who wishes to testify on House File 922? Please come on down. All right, welcome, and I must say this is a familiar face,
yes.
My constituent, Ms. Patricia Magnuson, and she's at a different school district
I
now,
am.
But still doing tremendous work, so thanks for being here.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chair Loon, Representative Drazkowski, and committee members. Thank you for giving me this opportunity to testify about this bill. I'm the Executive Director of Finance and Operations for Osseo Area Schools. And I've worked in Minnesota School District Finance for over 20 years, and I'm a past president of the Minnesota Association of School Business Officials. And I want to remind you, as you know, as district officials, it's our duty to get results for students. And we do that with the funding that's been entrusted to us by state and federal government and by our local taxpayers. And we work closely with our school boards and our school communities every day to obtain the capital funding necessary to meet the goals we have for our students. Adequate capital funding, as you know, that is tied to local needs is an important tool that allows us to focus on students and receive results for them. Unfortunately, capital funding is stretched thin to meet the needs of our aging facilities and the changing uses of our facilities as we educate students in the 21st century. Voter-approved capital funding in the form of both capital projects levies for technology or bond issues for capital needs are an important tool available to school communities. Our communities hold us accountable for bringing forward the most cost-effective and fiscally responsible requests that we can. Capital funding usually accompanies the acquisition of debt in an unpredictable lending market and major construction in a very narrow Minnesota construction season. Flexibility and timing of these kinds of bond elections allows districts to work collaboratively with our local communities to reach consensus on proposals and bring forward requests that are timed in a way that optimizes financing and construction timelines. It's not always perfect, but if timing were limited to once a year, an entire construction season or favorable interest rate market could be lost. This is not the best we can do for our communities. It's widely known that voter turnout is lower when elections are held outside of a general election date. This does not make us less accountable for the needs of our students, doesn't make us less accountable toward our fiscal responsibility, nor does it make us less accountable for the impact of our requests on our taxpayers. It simply makes our job of communicating even more important. I would argue that off-general elections can often draw more focused scrutiny because they are not lost in conversations that surround a general election and allow us to more clearly articulate our requests. Why voters don't turn out is their responsibility. We are very clear, no matter if it's a general election date or a non-general election date. I've been involved in 5 elections. All of them, as Representative Marquardt pointed out, were on general election dates. That's because it worked for that community and that timing. It doesn't always work that way. And the local communities know best what they need, what their students need, and what's the best timing for their local community. We're held accountable for our work. We do it in public, and we discuss the impact on taxpayers all the time, but especially annually at our truth and taxation hearing. That's the place where our taxpayers get to hear about the impact that we're having on them and give us a response to that. Clear and adequate communication is an important part of our duty to our communities. We live in these communities. That's where we send our children to school. It's where we attend church. It's where we do our grocery shopping. It's where we check out our library books. We see our communities and our constituents every day. Voter-approved capital funding is an important funding source. Local control over the timing of these elections allows school districts to meet the needs of our community's students and use our local expertise to bring forward the most fiscally responsible proposal that we can. House File 922 simply strips this local control. I urge you to continue to hold us accountable for the results we get for students, for our impact on our taxpayers, and for explaining the decisions we make to our local community. House File 922 is not a step in that direction. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Kelleher?
Good afternoon, members, and Chair Loon. Grace Kelleher with the Minnesota School Boards Association. Our association represents every school district in the state of Minnesota. And I want to start out by thanking Representative Drazkowski. I know he's hanging back there, but he has, on a lot of these bills, worked very closely with us to try and come to some kind of harmony. And I have the sad news to say that he did not find harmony on this bill in front of you today. So I just want to share a couple pieces that are really key. There is a fiscal ramification with this bill at the local level. It would require some of our projects to wait another 9 months, another 10 months till we get into the ground, and their costs attached to staggering that project back so they all came out on the election day. Second of all, I want to debunk some of the information you heard. I pulled the last 5 years. MSBA keeps track of referendums, when they're offered, and then what the win-loss ratio is. And I don't have the information with me today, but I'd be happy to share it with the committee. But here's the skinny. Half of the districts are in off years. Half of the districts are on election day. The passage rates between off and on election day for the last 5 years show no real difference. There's maybe 1 point difference between the two. We oftentimes are really challenged by the legislature to become very prudent and efficient in our spending and our investments going forward. And I would really ask that you trust your local boards enough to allow them on these capital projects that could be driven by a lot of older issues, after we go out to the voters to do in off years. And lastly, this will be my last comment, I promise. Schools are the only ones who have to go to the voters for approval. And it's been a high bar you've kept for school districts for the last 25 years. I would, since we already have to go and get voter approval on not only this option, but any ongoing operating referendums, I am not sure why you would once again marginalize us back to only one day to do it while you allow the other local governments the freedom to levy what they need when they need it. So. With that, Madam Chairman, I'd be happy to answer questions, and I will provide the committee with that data on the elections.
Thank you. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Gary Amoroso, Executive Director of Minnesota Association of School Administrators. I'll be very brief because many of the points have already been made. From our members' perspectives, this is a local control issue. I sit at the meetings within the legislature, and I hear our legislators talk about wanting to retain local control, empowering our communities, empowering our school districts to make decisions on behalf of children. This would be an example of going in the opposite direction of doing that. Our school board members, when they make a decision to have a local election of this nature, is held accountable by the voters. The voters who voted these people into office will hold them accountable if they're displeased with either the timing of the election or if they're displeased with the content of the election. And that's exactly, from our perspective, where that accountability needs to be held, is at the level of closest implementation, and that is the local level. In terms of the dollars and cents with things like this, from experiences as a superintendent, costs go up. Ms. Kelleher just indicated that costs can go up over 6 months, 9 months, 12 months. When we were superintendent in Lakeville, we lost a significant bond election to build a second high school. That was defeated in November of a year. We had meetings with our community. We did focus groups. They said, here's what you need to do. We came back that following April. But because of that six-month lag, we had to increase the actual cost of the bond questions by $1.9 million. So time truly is money when you have these types of conversations. And so we're hoping that you'll take some of these thoughts into account. We want to be held accountable not only by the legislature, but we need to be held accountable by our public. And by restricting these types of elections, we're really taking that accountability away from the public. And would hope you would consider that. So thank you for that. And I would snap for questions for Danny.
Thank you. Hey, and first, gentlemen, come sit down, Mr. Amoroso. I just want to admire the wardrobe. Is there some new uniform for school representatives I'm not aware of?
Madam Chair, I hope you know that during my comments, I saw cameras going, and it was very difficult for me not to start laughing as I was providing my testimony. But the senior member of the organizations here, I think, why do we work?
Well, I think we're real estate agents. And,
starting real Century 21.
Well, you all look very dapper. Thank you. Mr. Kirkus.
Madam Chair, we thought everyone knew that Thursday was camel hair court day, but apparently, apparently not. Madam Chair, Member Scott Kroonquist with the Association of Metropolitan School Districts, and I'll try not to be too repetitive because they share some of the concerns that were already expressed. But let me just touch on a couple other different issues. Number one, I think it was the comment was made that we want to make sure the voters, there's more participation and more informed voters, and that moving it to November would accomplish that. And I think actually the opposite is true. When our school districts are on the ballot in a general election year, especially in a presidential year, they have an incredibly difficult time trying to break through and get their message out. In fact, they are just oftentimes overwhelmed. They cannot compete with the multi-million dollar ad campaigns that are going on with the presidential race, the U.S. congressional races, state Senate, state House races. And so we end up with hundreds, if not thousands, of undervotes. And I think you all know this. If you go look at the election results, and you'll see the total votes cast, and it drops off considerably, especially by the time you get down to the school races, because people are showing up and they don't know. They get there, I don't know about this, I didn't hear about this. Even though they all got a first-class mailing, which is required by law, our school districts have to do a first-class mailing explaining the question, explaining the vote, the levy impact. And so by contrast, if you hold an election away from that, if you're the only thing on the ballot, it's very clear what people are going to vote for. They're showing up to vote on that very important school question. And again, we are required to get that information out to the taxpayers by first-class mail. So there's really no, I don't think the argument that voters aren't aware or don't know about the issue holds water. Then, Madam Chair, the amendment, the A4 amendment, I just have to say we are concerned about that. About a dozen years ago, and I think it actually happened over a couple different legislative sessions, you all, the legislature at that time, made changes to simplify the ballots. We used to have half a page, almost legal requirements, in our school referendum questions. And great progress was made to simplify them. And I'm very concerned now that if voters step in, and now the ballot question has to state how much the school district is levying for local optional revenue, how much for board-approved levy authority. First of all, how many voters are going to understand what that means? I mean, how many people in this room would understand that? You know, and we're all supposedly in the know on that. So we think we're moving actually in the wrong direction by making a ballot question longer and more complicated. So I'll stop there, Madam Chair, members. Thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Brad Lundell, the Schools for Equity Education, just here largely to echo much of what's been said in our concerns about this bill. I think Mr. Kroonquist really hit on some of the points that I was going to cover, and mostly about the complexity of many of these issues. And when those issues get lost in larger general election issues, it becomes difficult to discern for many voters, not the right or wrong of things, but just it gets lost. Everything gets lost in the shuffle. I think that, you know, we've got a lot of folks. I've got district that's going out in May now, and I think that they've had several failed attempts at passing a debt service, a debt bond. And I think that, again, having that ability to go back to voters to clarify how we have changed our, how we've changed the question in the past, what we're looking for this time, how we're moving forward, I think it's very, very important, because when you're isolated and you have that chance to look at things very clearly, those questions very clearly in the community, I think it's very, very helpful, because then the dialogue between the school district and the voters is much more direct and certainly not compromised by other discussions that may be going on in other elections. So with that, I'll certainly just wanted to say our concern about this bill, but then we'll stand for any questions later. Thank you.
Thank you. Welcome.
Paul Winkler with Education Minnesota. I'd like to speak with the rest of everybody that spoke here today and really reiterate what we tell our members when they support a levy, that when you can have the flexibility to do these timelines around capital projects and the needs of students, the conversations really at the doors or on the phones is actually much richer when you can have the time and the place and the space when it's not getting buried by 80 pieces of campaign lit or 10 pieces that are showing up every day. And when you can really focus on what the needs of the community are, it's, I think it creates a better vote pattern for why it's passing, and people are engaged in that. I would also reiterate why I think they fail, and I work on about 30 to 40 levies across the state every year, and they often fail because they become about adults. And if the voters in the districts believe that they're doing these elections, say, in May, for sneaky reasons, they're severely punished at the ballot box for trying to be sneaky. So that's my experience with passing levies across the state. Thank you.
Thank you. Is there anyone else from the public who wishes to testify? Not seeing any. I think we'll move to member questions. Any questions from committee members? Representative Murphy.
Madam Chair, Representative Drazkowski, I haven't read this very well, but what about if we have open voting for a period of time before the election where people can go to vote? Will that have any impact on the preparation of the issue?
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Murphy, none that I'm aware of. As I understand it, our early balloting that we've kind of moved to in Minnesota would still contain the same ballots, and I understand things would be pretty well the same, unless Mr. Strom knows of something differently.
And so,
Representative Murphy.
Madam Chair, so the arguments that Mr. Scott,
Grunquist
and Mr. Amoroso gave, might that be alleviated if we do have a voting open for a longer period of time, and first class mail might not be competing with third class mail to the same degree at that time, and so maybe there will be more informed participation if we adopt your bill?
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Murphy, I haven't really thought about that, but you might be onto something. I mean, if school districts, as they put this out there, and if it happens to be a general election year, are afraid that they're going to get flooded with all kinds of mail and get lost in the noise, that they could, do a more focused job earlier when there's less noise. I hadn't really thought about that, but that could be an outcome if that's a concern they might have.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions? All right, seeing none. Closing comments, Representative Drazkowski.
Not really, Madam Chair. Thank you. Thank you, members. And there was discussion about local control. And, one of the things when we were hearing some other bills in the Property Tax Committee, and I really truly in my heart believe that most local control is that of the people. And if we can develop policy here in Minnesota that involves people to the greatest degree, that they can be involved in our elections, I think we have the best example of local control. Appreciate your support for the bill.
Thank you. All right, so with that, I would renew my motion that House File 922 as amended be re-referred to the Tax Committee. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? All right, motion's passed. Your bill is on its way to property taxes. Thank you, Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
And let's move now to your next bill, House File 2077. And this is an informational-only hearing, as I understand it.
Yes, Madam Chair. I had talked with Mr. Withers earlier if I could introduce the bill and then head back to my other committee. And would that work okay?
That would be just fine.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, members, House File 2077 is a bill that develops a program of, and I don't have the bill in front of me here. that provides an agricultural credit to schools that it would send a credit to schools, and then it would be acknowledged on the property tax statement of those landowners that own class 2A, 2B, and 2C land. 2A land is our arable farmland. 2B is the farmland that is not arable or is wooded. And 2C, as I understand, is forestry land, private forestry land. But it would send an amount equal to half of 50% of the existing school, and I got to get the terminology right here in front of the Education Committee. I'm trying to learn. The school construction bond referendum money. Help me, Mr. Strom.
Madam Chair, I'm sorry, Representative Draskowski. I was momentarily distracted and missed the question.
Okay, I'm fine. Okay. They're with me. Anyway, so if it would offset half of the existing tax liability each year for those landowners by sending the state government would send a check to the school, as I understand it, and then it would be acknowledged on the property tax statement of those land of those property owners that own class 2A, 2B, and 2C land, that half of their property tax has for that construction levy has been offset by the state. And that's essentially what the bill does. It's a different approach rather than the house, garage, and an acre bill that we heard here a couple weeks ago. And so that's the bill in a nutshell, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Is there anyone who wishes to testify on this? And while you're coming down, I know you have to leave, Representative Draskowski. Any questions for Representative Draskowski? Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative, like your bill very much, and just a clarification, would this apply only to new bond referendums or existing ones as well?
Representative Draskowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Anderson, it would apply to all existing referendums and continue to apply to existing referendums going forward, whether they're new at that time or, 10 years old. And Madam Chair, if I could, yes. The amount is, the way the bill is written out, would amount to about $47 or $49 million a year is the way it is written at, the 50% offset level, the way the bill is written currently. Maybe Mr. Strom has the exact number in front of him, but it's in that ballpark.
Other questions at this point? All right, we'll go ahead and hear public testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Brad Lundell Schools for Equity and Education. I want to thank Representative Draskowski for bringing this forward. We've worked with him on some bills this year to mitigate the effects of property taxes on ag land, especially as it relates to the debt service equalization. The ag land is on the adjusted net tax capacity tax base, and because of that, because of the rising levels of ag land values, the extremely fast and high now. And I think the other thing is that equalizing factors are also calculated on per pupil amounts. And in rural Minnesota, especially these areas where you have very heavy ag land, you have very few students, those districts look a lot more property wealthy and income wealthy than they actually are. And I think that that's something that needs to be mitigated and looked for, because there are facilities needs in those districts. And oftentimes that's going to require a not just deferred maintenance, but it's going to require building new buildings. And I think that we prefer to this approach to the approach with the house and garage 1 acre is that it doesn't push the burden onto other types of property. I think they can work in conjunction with each other in some respects. And also I think we want to put in plug for more debt service, as just the more of the basic debt service program probably needs to be updated as well. But I think we've talked about a lot of different things here and a lot of different ways to get at that ag land issue, especially as it relates to debt service equalization. And I think that, again, glad that Representative Draskowski has brought this forward and entered it into the discussion. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Madam Chairman and members. My name is Grace Kelleher, and I represent the Minnesota School Boards Association. This is one of the items I referenced earlier that we really worked with Representative Draskowski on. We had heard from our membership as we traveled around the state that places that had a lot of farm property in their base were having trouble actually passing facility referendums. And so board members were looking for solutions that made sense. In fact, we have a board member who's out of Marshall whose nephew owns a farm right outside of it. So uncle is on the school board, and they're trying to pass a referendum because they're in desperate need of space, and it would have cost his large farm about $600,000 total. And that's a lot of money for a family to absorb. And so it became really clear early on that some kind of shift has happened in the state of Minnesota onto this farmland. And it could be the skyrocketing values. I mean, it's a complicated solution. Luckily, this bill in front of you was really what came out of our discussions, that a direct credit infused into the people who need it the most made the most sense. And so I want to, if he was here, I'd be thanking Representative Duszkowski. I mean, we probably met 9 or 10 times and ran multiple models, and it was sort of nice. I had always dreamed of the day I'd sit at the table with the Farm Bureau and say, we really like this bill. And he actually brought it forward. So I want to say thanks to him. Thank you, Madam Chair, for hearing this bill. We support this approach.
Thank you. Is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to offer testimony on House Bill 2077? Not seeing any, and our author had to leave, so I just thought it was worth the committee's time to hear it while Representative Duszkowski was here. So thank you. Representative Isaacson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I just want to, first of all, thank the committee for their indulgence on hearing my bill. I really appreciate it. So,
you made a good pitch to me, Representative Isaacson. So I will go ahead and move your bill to get it formally before us. So I would move that House Bill 1897 be re-referred to Ways and Means, but with the Chair's intention of laying it over today for possible inclusion in a later bill.
Wonderful.
And please go ahead and present your bill.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Past session in 2014, I offered House File 2861, which asked MDE to determine the content and status of career and technical education programs in Minnesota public schools. From that, they did their, I call it an audit, so to speak. We got about 60 to 65% return rate on that audit and got a really good, clear understanding of a major part of how career and technical education is going in our state. House File 1897 is a result of that audit. What did the audit find? Well, and perhaps sadly not surprisingly, what it discovered is that we are woefully lacking in programming and class offerings and career and technical education across the board in all aspects of whatever you might even consider to be career and technical education. We are lacking teachers and the ability to recruit them. We're lacking the ability to license them, and we're lacking the ability to keep them, as many of those folks are now retiring. We're lacking adequate equipment. Sadly, if we think of the program as being inadequate, the equipment we have is inadequate to meet the inadequate programming, if that makes any sense. So if the programming is not doing well, the equipment we have doesn't even meet the needs of what it already is an inadequate program. And finally, and perhaps one that was a little more interesting to me, was that we really lack school day flexibility in allowing for career and technical education courses to be a prominent or at least a significant portion of a student's day. And part of that problem is that the way we've structured kind of how our academic day works and our requesting and testing and those kind of things, what it really highlights for me isn't so much a knock on testing as much as it is a knock on the fact that this just isn't seen as a priority the way we see other things as a requirement for graduation. So what I did is I sat down with folks from MDE and other stakeholders, and I asked, you know, just what would it take for us to get on the right page in 4 years? Financially, what would we have to do to put ourselves on a place where we would feel proud of our career technical education programs across the state of Minnesota. The number went so high that we stopped counting, because we would break the bank trying to fix that hole we've dug for ourselves. And I think the reason why I call it a hole is I really want to be clear about something. We are largely, and I think many Minnesotans are fairly oblivious, or at least not as aware as they should be, of exactly how problematic this situation is for us in our current education system, and also for our current economy and our ability to fill jobs. I don't think we understand how grave of a situation we're in terms of the way we've neglected career and technical education in Minnesota over the last 20 years. And in many ways, we've neglected it because we've seen this shift where we went to a four-year school approach and really highlighting what that is, and at the expense of the career and technical education programs. And I can look at it by talking to career and technical teachers and students about what they used to do and what we're doing now and how hard it is to find money for funding for schools and how we're having to go outside in many different sources. And you're going to hear about a grant that White Bear Lake got to help mitigate some of those problems with lack of funding that, frankly, we haven't been able or have been unwilling to take care of ourselves. My proposal is not that we should then take back away from the four-year school. I think we need to keep that priority as being important. But we need to expand what exactly is it that it, what does it mean to be in a post-secondary option? What does it mean to have a post-secondary track when you leave high school? Is it simply getting a liberal arts four-year degree? I think that Minnesota needs to broaden its horizons on this. And how they can do that is saying everything from precision manufacturing to philosophy is a post-secondary option. Whether you want to be an HVAC technician, a dental hygienist, a history teacher, or an engineer, we should have the possibility for you and your high schools to pursue that which interests you, to go and then have some skills that you're either ready to go right into a post-secondary option to get the skills, or already have the skills to go right into a job. You're going to hear today about two examples, an example of each of those options that are currently occurring through extraordinary work by individuals, not through the help and support from the state legislature. So I think that what I'm really trying to illustrate is that when I looked at how much it would cost for us to really bring back career technical education into Minnesota, it was clear to me that we had dug a very deep hole. And then it was also clear to me that we didn't have the money to fix that right now. And this isn't your classic argument about throwing money at education, is it being spent well? This is your argument about, do we have drill presses? Do we have microwave ovens for family and consumer science courses? Do we have laser printers or laser cutters? Do we have fab labs? Do we have saws? Do we have the necessary wood material we need for wood shops? Do we have the equipment we need for small engine repair? These kind of things. We have dug ourselves such a deep hole that I said, okay, so if we can't fix it, what can we do to start taking steps to mitigate it and over time understand how we can solve it? Well, the first thing we can do is we can raise the floor. Let's raise the floor so when we write our next bill on this, we're not having to be quite so remedial and we can be more proactive. And that's what House File 1897 does, is I'm trying to raise the floor at the bottom of this pit up to a manageable spot so in 2 years or a year we can come back and continue to take steps towards rectifying what I think is a real problem in our state. And the reason I say that is because I'm on the jobs committee, and I work in career and technical education for higher education and with jobs. And what I have found is that there are thousands of manufacturing jobs right now we can't fill. Thousands. And why is that? Well, I don't think it takes too much of a leap to think to yourself, we have completely neglected ourselves on career and technical education over the last 20 years, and now, when we're in the middle of somewhat of a manufacturing renaissance to some degree in Minnesota, we're not able to fill those spots. Right? That seems to add up to me. And so I'm hoping that we can begin to address that problem with House File 1897. So that being said, House File 1897 does three things. One, it provides for grant funding on a needs-based approach through MDE to give the schools money they need to either repair, replace, or expand their current career and technical education programs. If they have two drill presses that are broken down and they need four for their shop class, they can apply for money to get the first two repaired and then to buy two more. The second thing it can do, along with the same lines I should say, we have many places that are operating with equipment that's as old as the 1960s and that needs to be replaced, right? Especially when we get into areas that require computer technology and manufacturing. Right, and so the idea is that these grants will let these programs at least try to get adequate to the current program offerings we have, at least have the equipment that works for what we are offering right now. The second thing it does is it provides for innovation. And what I mean by that is when these schools are now looking for other alternatives of sources of funding and the way they interact with their local community, they see what the economic needs are. What are the jobs that are available? What industries are driving their local economic engine? We should help our schools meet those needs. We should be saying if there is a large CNC manufacturing base in their region, if a school wants to develop a CNC manufacturing career and technical education program, we should help them innovate to reach out and do that, to meet the needs of their economic engines and the jobs that are available out there. Thirdly, what it does is it provides grants for recruitment and retention of teachers. And I know this is a touchy subject, and I know we argue about licensure and all that kind of crazy stuff, but I really want to make it simple. We cannot get teachers to come to Minnesota to work in rural Minnesota in career and technical education. We are not producing teachers in Minnesota until this year. Last year we didn't even have a school that offered it, that actually produced graduates in career and technical education. We are having a serious problem with recruiting and retaining these folks. So I want to provide some financial incentives to bring teachers into Minnesota, especially rural Minnesota. And how can we do that? Well, we can offer them better pay. That'd be one way to go. Another way to go is if they have to get licensed, if someone from the mythical Bob's Manufacturing has been welding all his life and he retires and wants to do something new and would love to teach welding in our high schools, well, let's pay him to get his license so he can come and teach for us. Because we need those teachers. And you're going to hear an interesting story later on about how Illinois has been trying to poach our teachers with more money, because they're having the same problem we are. So it not only will ask us to help with recruiting, but it'll also help us to retain these teachers and want to keep them in our communities. So the bill asks for, and you can see it in front of you, several million dollars. And I know that it's like squeezing butt from a rock at this point, because everybody's asking for $7 million, and I'm sure you've heard, just like I am, that, you know, this is absolutely the most important thing in the world, right? And so I get that I'm kind of barking up the same tree everybody else is. But I hope that you'll listen to the testimony today, and then my closing comments, and we won't take up too much of your time, but you'll get a real flavor for what we are trying to do out there, what's been done by some innovative teachers, and how we can expand that to be a part of our state. So I'm going to turn it over to the testifiers, and I think I'm actually going to start with you first, if that's okay. Introduce yourself. And
welcome.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and fellow committee members. My name is Brian Hogue, and I'm a media arts instructor at Roseville Area High School. I have been teaching at Roseville for 25 years. I've previously taught another 5 years at North St. Paul. I was also an operations manager for a large commercial graphics company here in the Twin Cities, and I also own my own sign company for 10 years. I'm here today to tell you that I've been in this business a long time, and I have to tell you, when I started teaching, I started my teaching career at what the teachers call the end of the glory years. And what they meant by that was, I teach graphic arts, I teach printing. And I don't teach printing presses anymore, folks. Those went by the wayside. Although I still know a lot of schools that are still teaching that today. You could call on the phone on a Monday, ask for a printing press, and by Friday, it was in your lab. Today, if I did that, I would hear a click. Okay. In my 30-year career as a teacher, without question, this is the most significant bill I have ever heard of in my career for career and technical education. And pardon my following words, but I've always likened career and tech ed in the public school system as we're the bastard stepchild. We're the ones that if there's pennies left over at the end, we may get them. We may have to apply for grants. We may have to claw, scratch, kick to get anything we want. Take a tech teacher, give him a dollar. He'll turn it in, or she will turn it into 20. I think we've been part of the problem. We've taken those 1960s vintage equipment and we've jury-rigged them and patched them and kept patching and patching to make do, hoping someday down the road there would be relief. There hasn't been. We've taken a little bit different approach at Roseville. I knew the money, when I came back to teaching out of industry, I knew the money wouldn't be there. Never has in my career. So we started a business. We started a for-profit company that today our entire program that has $2.5 million in equipment, there's not $1 taxpayer money in my lab. We've paid for it all. We've worked with our fellow businesses in the area, And I went to every single business and I said, if I was to provide you an entry-level worker that could walk in day one and be profitable, any minuscule percentage of business that you would lose to me, would that be worth it to you? I have not had a single business owner in the Roseville area in my 25 years say, we're taking away business from them. In fact, today I have more job offers than I have students. I have several companies, one in particular, a company called CompuType in Roseville. That business owner is going to lose two-thirds of his workforce in the next 7 years. He's offered my senior graduates, he offers two positions a year, offers them a 12-week internship starting at $12 an hour. At the end of that 12 weeks, if the student worked out well, he offers them a full-time job, $17 an hour, full benefits, and he will pay their entire college career. That's how desperate some of these companies are for technical people today. On another note, Representative Isaacson mentioned that in terms of teacher retention, we're having some serious problems. I think he put it quite mildly. Every tech ed teacher that I work with in Roseville area with less than 15 years of experience received a letter in November from the state of Illinois offering that if they would relocate to Illinois, they would get a $30,000 signing bonus and a 2-to-4-step raise in whatever they were making in their current district. As of today, the state of Illinois is 48 technical teachers short. Wisconsin, 38. I don't even know where we're at. I have a fellow colleague member that is going to be retiring next March. She teaches graphic design and photography. We don't know where we're going to get that person. I'm having to go to California in July on my own money to see if I can go and recruit somebody from somewhere around the country to come teach a program. And we have an outstanding program, and we still are having difficulty finding replacement people. It is a huge problem. And I hate to say this, but I think it's only the tip of the iceberg. I think it's going to get way worse before it'll get better. So there's lots of creative things going out there. I think this is definitely something, and as, again, Representative Isaacson said, you have a lot of hands coming out. You know, we need money, money, money. But I can tell you this, that this is something that will make an impact. We hear every day in the media, closing the achievement gap. My second hour is a partial shelter content class. I have 15 students from 7 different countries, mainly Karen at this point, who came out of the jungles of Burma and trying to make a better life here in this country. Two of those students are going to get full-time jobs this summer. Those full-time jobs are going to support their families, and those students are 18 years old. So if you don't think this money will make a difference, think again. It's going to make a huge impact. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hogue. Welcome.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Tim Walden, principal at Wiper Lake Area High School. I've been in that role for 10 years and an educator for 23 years. One of the important conversations we have in schools is how we can create innovative and impactful post-secondary pathways for our students. And we've been strategic in our efforts, developing technology initiatives, one-to-one initiatives that many of our schools are working on right now. We've rewritten curriculum to assure modern and relevant schools. We've created concurrent enrollment course opportunities. And these efforts have created excellent pathways to four-year universities. Where we're missing students is pathways to career and technical opportunities. There are many, many livable wage opportunities for students that they're missing because our curriculum, our standards that our state requires of us, steer kids towards four-year universities, which is an absolutely great decision for many students, but not the right decision and a poor investment for others. And so as schools try to create career pathways into vocational opportunities, there are a lot of barriers. One of them is the cost of maintaining equipment and attaining equipment. We just rolled out a manufacturing pathway in White Bear Lake, and it happened because we had conversations with manufacturing industry leaders asking what the career opportunities looked like and do they think they could be at the table and help us with this. And they came out of the woodwork in a matter of moments, we had 15 industry partners, and they're excited. That led to us receiving some grants, thanks to the United Way. We have $250,000 to roll out this pathway. And even that, while it seems to us like a lot of money, it's just a start for us in a manufacturing pathway. Manufacturing in Minnesota is a high-tech industry. It's not a greasy, dirty job, and students need to have skills. The equipment we bought 25 years ago to help students develop careers in manufacturing is far less relevant. We still need much of that equipment, and we work hard to maintain it. We'll need to replace some of that. But we also need high-tech 3D printers and the like if we're going to prepare students for a high-tech manufacturing industry. So we're excited to roll that out, and we've also, in our discussions with industry, we've identified other career pathways that we're excited to get rolling on. IT is an industry that, in the area where we're at in White Bear Lake, there are jobs. Construction, there are jobs. And in health careers, we have some of the, not only working with patients, but within manufacturing related to health careers, we have multiple billion-dollar medical manufacturers in the White Bear Lake northern suburban areas. So there's a lot of work to be done. This bill will help us by writing grants, being strategic in our efforts, will help us attain some funds to move our career pathways forward. Secondly, in the metro area, we have maybe a little less trouble than the rural areas attracting teachers, but it's a challenge. And then when we find those teachers and we have them on board, the training to be able to teach high-tech manufacturing is intense training. It usually will require summer training. It's expensive training. It takes a lot of teacher time to do that. And so this bill will help us get teachers the training they need to develop the career pathways. There's a demand for career pathways in our schools. When we, like I said, when we rolled this out with manufacturing industry, they jumped out of the woodwork to be a part of it. And it's happening very quickly. In a year's time, this is happening. And we know that's the case with IT, health careers, and construction as well. But what we weren't so certain of is, are the kids going to be there? And so we held a manufacturing showcase event last December, and we had eight manufacturing partners who partnered with us on that event. We held it on a Monday night in the school theater, and we kind of whispered to each other, are we going to get 25 people to show up for this? We had about 175 show up that night. And it was moms or dads with their kid looking at the different displays, participating in a panel discussion with industry leaders, charting their future. So the demand is there with our kids. The industry is ready to move with us. Maybe the last ones to move on this are schools and the legislature. So if we can support Representative Isaacson's bill, I think this is a good first step. Thank you. With me, Dan Rossiter, who is a technology education teacher in White Bear Lake Schools.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair. As Tim just said, I've been teaching in White Bear Lake for over 20 years in technical education. One of the things that I would like to address is also when we talk about CTE, majority of the technology education teachers out there right now, I would say, do not have their CTE license. It's something that was not addressed during their college time. So when we talk about retraining educators, that would be critical for that revenue stream to come into the schools. So that's one of the big things that I've noticed. Now, as far as teaching technology education or tech ed, I've seen a big pendulum effect. My father-in-law was in education, and he told me years ago that don't go into technology education, there's no jobs, no jobs. Well, at the time, there was no jobs. And then all of a sudden, when I first got hired in White Bear Lake, I could have named my price at which step I wanted to come in. It was a bargaining chip. We're hearing Illinois is doing that right now. So there is a pendulum, and right now, not only is White Bear Lake kind of understanding the need for bringing in manufacturing. But prior to that, we brought in an engineering curriculum. And as you heard earlier, we are not given that. We have to go out and get a levy, or not a levy, but a grant for that program. And we did get a Kern grant for $65,000, and that was 7 years ago. And that program has been very successful. But the engineering curriculum is not just for future engineers. It's also for people that want to learn about the CAD, the design process, and many different vocational skills. So we have had a lot of success. And how do I measure success? In the 20 years of teaching, I probably had 4 or 5 times a student ask me to write them a letter of recommendation for either college or employment opportunities. This past year, I've already written 25 letters of recommendation for either going to college or possible employment opportunity. So we are getting those skills out there to make students employable right out of high school, but we still have a lot of work to do. The other thing I would like to touch base is, Tim mentioned we did get a grant from the United Way. And that took a lot of work, a lot of time on teachers' time to get that $250,000 grant. Now, that sounds like a lot of money, but when you buy a piece of equipment that is $100,000, it doesn't go very far. And what we are trying to do is develop manufacturing skills for students, so when they have an opportunity to graduate, they still can look at a 2-year, 4-year college, but also a place to work and earn money. As I look at our curriculum and our in engineering and soon to be manufacturing, I've had several success stories over the years. I've had students that had special needs to be able to get into a Century College and go through their computer-aided design program and find a great job. Before that time, they were somewhat lost and didn't know what to do. They were frightened because of their future. So when I look at what this bill can present, it can give many students opportunities. Along with the engineering curriculum, one of the things that it did is it opened the door to form partnerships with several industries in our community. We are currently working with, I'll just throw this name out there, DeFrame Manufacturing. It's a local manufacturing company that does a lot of stamping and pressing of metal in making lockers or making metal objects. And they're starved for workers. They know in the near future, like tech ed teachers or CTE teachers, they're not going to find manufacturing workers, and they're very worried. So they've been a big part of us implementing our manufacturing curriculum. And so far, everything's going well. But as Tim mentioned, implementing manufacturing curriculums, there are a lot of obstacles we are facing. And one of the obstacles is the stigma of manufacturing being dark, dirty, and dingy, or the notion that manufacturing is dead. And Representative Isaacson said that it's alive and well, and good-paying jobs, livable wage jobs for people out there. So we know that's not true, but to maintain a good manufacturing program or a path where students can earn a certification called the NIMS certification, which is the National Institute for Metalworking Skills Certification, which is recognized by manufacturing companies all over the world, they are going to be able to get started on that path. So if they you know, there's 5 different levels there, but what we can offer is level 1 and 2, where they can go and not work as an entry-level position. They'll be able to get a position higher up there. So basically, I just think the House File 1897 would be a great thing to pursue. So I'd like to thank you for your time today.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, Committee. My name is Michael Johnston, and I'm a junior at White Bear Lake Area High School. I'm really honored and pleased to be speaking in front of you today. Ever since I was a little kid, I enjoyed going into my dad's factory and watching all the machines work. When I was in fifth and sixth grade, I attended the Project Lead the Way Gateway Academy camp. This was my first hands-on engineering experience. And some of the projects that we did was using a 3D printer and launching model rockets. In ninth grade, I took the Intro to Engineering Design course and learned the basic CAD program Autodesk Inventor. We built and designed a lamp and a puzzle in that class. I've also taken a part in my school's robotics team where I have learned to use different machines, some of which are 25 years old, so they're getting kind of out of date. I'm currently taking the digital electronics class and enjoy the challenges that we face in it. We have designed circuits on the computer using multi-SIM, then wiring them up on a breadboard using integrated circuit chips and wires. Another project that we've done is making a voting machine. Through digital electronics, I was able to tour two local factories and was fascinated by all the machines that they had there. Based on these tours, I believe that we need updated machines in our school to better prepare us for what is out there. We also need to make sure that we have the most updated CAD softwares. With all of these experiences that I have been given through school, I have found where my strengths and interests are. I really enjoy CAD and would like to use this in my career. I plan to go to college to become a packaging engineer. Others in my classes are exploring careers as technicians and looking into vocational schools. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. I appreciate you being here, and I think you've got a very bright future. I think I have a neighbor who does what you're interested in, so catch me after committee.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Isaacson.
Well, Madam Chair, I think you've just seen a small taste of what our possibilities are in this area, and I really just, again, can't stress enough that we're in a real, I think history will show us to be, and I might be a little melodramatic, but important turning point in our economy, and we have to make some choices, you know, and I understand that we have a lot of financial and some really tough choices to make this session, you know, and many of us are asking, can we afford to do this, can we afford to do that? But when you're thinking about a manufacturing renaissance, we're thinking about providing students of all talents opportunities to be successful and finding well-paying jobs. We're thinking about growing our economy and keeping some of the most engaged citizens in the world working hard in Minnesota. I don't know that we can afford not to. I think that's really my concern. And so, you know, I hope that you'll understand that, you know, I'm being a little bit strident about that, but I really think that we did the homework. We did the homework, and the homework is clear. It is clear that we are falling behind faster than we understand, and that we're coming across some lines of no return if we don't start turning this around as soon as we can. And so I don't think it's something we can fix overnight, but I do believe that the first step we can take is let's get some of that remedial work done, let's bring the floor up on what we are doing right now in our state, and then let's take another hard look at what needs to be the next step. And understand that, you know, it's probably going to take several bienniums, several legislatures to get us through this to the place we need to be. But I think that, you know, if we take the time to retool these folks now, when the next recession comes, we're going to be in a better position to handle it, and we're going to come out of it faster and stronger. And so I hope that we can take advantage of what seems to be a little better economic times now to really shore up where we're deficient and make ourselves stronger. So with that, I just really appreciate your time, and if there's any questions for me or the testifiers, you should know, don't let his good looks fool you. He's testified at Congress before. He knows what he's doing. He plays the young guy here, but he has more experience than I do, so
Congress.
Just be aware of that. Yeah, he's right. He's kind of a big deal.
Mr. Johnson, I have to ask you, how do we compare?
Awesomely, we're the best.
Yeah. It's not that bad.
Oh, the Minnesota compliment, I love it.
All right, I'll let you off the hook. No, that's very impressive. I'm glad you shared that with us. So, well, you did a great job. We're glad you're here. I do have a couple of members on the list, Representative Detmer and Representative Murphy. Oh, and Representative Mullery as well. Mm-hmm. Representative Detmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And you know, I taught at Forest Lake High School, and I know this has been a big part of our curriculum at Forest Lake, and this also ties into STEM, doesn't it, Representative Isaacson? And I think I asked a question before to staff here regarding the work-study program. Is that still part of our schools today, where a student can spend a half day at school and then go off a local business and work? Is that still going on?
I'm
speak to it.
Superintendent?
Yeah, very limited fashion. And partly because businesses are less interested in bringing young workers into their plants for safety purposes and insurance purposes. And to be honest, what Representative Isaacson said, the requirements for graduation, as they are written today, give very little flexibility for students, and work doesn't fit in very well. Nor does the opportunity to access technical education courses. And so the two teachers you heard today would have a lot more students in their classes if there's more flexibility. And so the standards, the requirements that we ask of our students today are very much geared toward preparing all students for access to a four-year college. And while we want doors to be open for our students, in doing so, I think we've limited access to vocational education for many of our students, or at least limited the opportunity for them to learn about vocational programs just through exploratory elective courses.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, and
Representative Detmer.
And maybe a comment to Mr. Johnson. When you, what year are you in high school right now?
I'm a junior.
A junior. Well, when you come to graduate, one company you should be looking at is Douglas Machine, Scientific Machine in Packaging. I remember that name. They're up in northern Minnesota, and that might be one that you might want to look at. So,
thank you.
He's available for an interview after school.
Actually, I'm his agent, so yeah. Good company.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, I was just wondering if this group is called the Iron Men. And if they have T-shirts.
I was tempted to do a little matchmaking, but then I realized those were eighth graders, so maybe that wasn't appropriate.
Yeah, and
we had a young women's robotic team here from Apple Valley yesterday. So.
We've talked about buying camel hair jackets.
Representative
Murphy.
Madam Chair, I do appreciate this bill and this energy and enthusiasm and informing us. It's not like we haven't heard some similar things previously in the bills that we have before us or that are being held over for possible inclusion. But I think back to my early days when I started my teaching career, and there were many more programs offered to the students for vocational training kind of possibilities and options. And I think about the participation that the local school district had in those programs with the federal government. And like other things that we've heard about in our funding of our programs, or just yesterday in the governor's program, he was putting more money in for Indian education, and that partially responsible for that is the decline of federal money keeping up. Special education, people came before us during this session and have made the case that we have to up the state's share of special education because the Fed is not meeting their promises. And I just didn't want the two people that mentioned about the guilt of that the legislature will hold if we don't largely embrace this bill. Part of that guilt has to be spread around to our federal partners, and in those days that I'm thinking of and mentioning, in the golden years, the heyday or whatever you want to call it, the federal money seemed to play a larger part in acquiring the equipment and the large number, and we were given the option just 2 months ago to find a new way to present equipment to people by the nine-week program. That was the materials would travel around, and eight school districts were going to, or eight counties or whatever, would be able to share the same equipment, and new people would get trained and all that kind of thing. And so this fits right in with the other things that we have to consider. And I do appreciate your enthusiasm, and I'm not going to stop talking until I ask you, the two teachers in this group, will you please tell me about the gender balance of the students that are participating in the programs that are being offered in your schools?
Mr. Representative Murphy, I can tell you in my particular situation, we are running over 50% female in our classes today. We see a very high percentage. That doesn't hold true with all of my colleagues in our department. Some are very male-dominated, but in the media arts, graphic arts area, the majority of our students are actually female, and the majority of my production students who run our business are actually, for the first time ever, female.
And, Madam Chair, and Mr. Hogue, that's right? Mr. Hogue, when you started your program, what was the balance?
I would say probably 90-10 male.
Okay, so you have made an improvement.
Considerably. Absolutely.
40%.
Way more than that.
Okay. And
Representative Murphy.
Mr. Rossiter.
Yes. I would say in our graphics program, it's very similar to the numbers over there. It's a very popular class for the female students. In our engineering course, I would say it's probably about 20% females at the school I'm teaching at. But where we started with the females with engineering, it was below 5% 6 years ago. So it has grown. And the nice thing that I'm seeing is, you know, it's a pathway for engineering. And the retention of the female, if you look at a percentage rate, is much better than the male students. So we are reaching out and making connections with the females, even in the engineering pathway.
Good. Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Mullery.
Madam Chair. First of all, Representative Isaacson, thank you for joining the issue. I started on this in my third month here back in 97, and at that time, most of the years since then, the only real help was from Mahoney and Carlson, so I'm glad you're joining it. And I think after banging my head against the wall over here for so many years, I've lost some of the enthusiasm that you still have, and I hope you can keep it. I did never give as long a speech as you did on it, but that was great. In fact, I think if you add up all my Bill talks in a year, probably not. But and my dad actually started out as a history teacher, and they needed, back then, they needed shop teachers, industrial arts, and he taught the, you mentioned printing, photography, what were some of the other graphics, he taught those plus all the shops. So I have a background in that. And by the way, Representative Murphy, your interest in females in the shop classes, my dad was at Patrick Henry in Minneapolis, and he let one of his homeroom students wanted to take a course, and he let a girl into his shop class and got immediately threatened with suspension if he ever did that again, because it was against school rules there in Minneapolis at the time. So things have changed. And I know, because working with companies, there's a huge, I've worked with companies in Western Hennepin, and they really have a good system going there, and they're just clamoring for more students. They're telling me that they're getting manufacturing jobs back from the South, and even from China, but they can't keep up with all that they can handle because they can't get the good students, the ones that are trained. And I was fortunate to meet with the Undersecretary of Labor for the U.S. Department of Labor a year and a half ago, and he told me that this is their plan. After working with businesses all over, the Obama administration came back and found that the business community said this is the way to get our economy going. So I'm really very supportive of this. Actually, a lot of the things that contributed to the downfall was the legislature and the changes in the formula that made it much more costly, and the legislature both, can't blame either party, they were both totally involved in that planning that really caused the phase out. I do have a concern, especially in inner city, because there's so many kids of color that are missing this opportunity. I think, as I said, the suburban schools still have some of this. Minneapolis, I think, only has three shops anymore. And so I'm wondering, I'm not seeing a lot from the suburban schools, and when I talk to manufacturers, about kids of color getting into this. And maybe it's, actually it's surprising, but some of the most affluent areas have the most shop classes in their high schools. How are you doing on kids of color?
Are you speaking to
either one of them?
Or Mr. Holm?
Yes, in Roseville, when I started in the district in 1991, our diversity was at 0.6%. Today, Roseville is roughly 42% and growing about 4 to 6% per year. In all of my classes,
I was just going to say, is that 42% of the school or
of the entire student body now?
Of the class, your classes,
or no, the entire student body at Roseville, 42% diversity, and we're growing at 4 to 6% a year. So it's changed considerably since I started there. Right now, I have a wide diversity of students. I had a class just last year, 28 students in class from 22 different countries. So things have changed a little bit. In terms of the students that I put into the world to work directly from Roseville, over half are diverse, of different nationalities, et cetera. I have a student right now who's being placed with a printing company in Roseville who recently immigrated from Nepal. And that job will support his family when he gets into it. So we do address a number of diverse populations currently at Roseville.
Thank you. And what about White Bear? I'm sorry, Madam Chair. Yep.
Yes, at White Bear, we're about 22%. And our courses run pretty much with that 22 to 25% of students. And this is an opportunity with this bill we're presenting. Is I think we'd attract a lot more students to that. If, you know, right now we're offering classes, but we need that big nugget. And these kids, you know, the counselors have been working really hard to try to get a lot more of those kids in the classes. And I have been seeing my numbers grow. So we're actually a little above where we're at as far as population-wise, 25% or so in my class.
And Madam Chair,
Representative Muller, we have one more bill we've got here today. So is it quick?
What about, you know, there's money in here for cost of very costly machines, and I'm wondering. I know you're near Century College. I think you teach at Century College, and unfortunately, they were one that kind of started phasing this out, as did MCTC under certain leadership, which I disagreed with, but. Partly, if we got Minsky back working with us on this, wouldn't it be cheaper to do the type of things that the chair has talked about for Anoka Hennepin and working with Anoka on these things if we could use some joint things with their equipment, set up a more type of thing like they're doing out there?
Madam Chair, that is precisely what I was hoping to learn from our audit, and it was shocking how little work is going on in the state between MinSKU and higher and K-12. And I don't think it's any because MinSKU hasn't wanted to or K-12 hasn't wanted to. It just hasn't, you know, the lack of funding. We've kind of all been running for cover, protecting our own that way. So I would say that I would agree 100%, and I'm on the Higher Education Committee, and I have a bill there. I'm working on that also. My goal is to reach up from K-12 and down from Minsky and find some happy place in the middle. We can start getting these students into a good place. So, yeah.
Good. I'm working on that. That's all.
Good. Great. Well, it's been a really great discussion.
Thank you.
And thank you, Representative Isaacson, and to all of the testifiers, especially you, Mr. Johnson. Thanks for being here today. And so with that, I'm going to renew my motion that House File 1897 be referred to Ways and Means, but laying it over today for possible inclusion in a later bill. Thank you all so much.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Really appreciate your time.
Thank you. Representative Freiberg, thank you for your patience.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the committee. I really appreciate you taking the time to squeeze us in, and I will be brief.
Let me just get your bill moved, because we are moving this on to the Capital Investment Committee.
So, that's correct.
I would move that House File 1248 be re-referred to the Capital Investment Committee. And please go ahead and tell us about your bill.
Sure. Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you also for being the second co-author on the author on the bill. I appreciate that greatly. House File 1248 is legislation that would convey the West Metro Education Program's Fair School Crystal to the Robbinsdale Area School District and Fair School Downtown to Minneapolis Public Schools. These two conveyances are broadly supported not only by the West Metro Education Program, or WEMEP as we call it in the West Metro Joint Powers Board, but also by the 11 member school boards and superintendents. WEMEP has had a long, thoughtful process arriving at the decision to convey its schools and has included families, students, and staff in the discussions and plan. Some of you may recall the EMID conveyances, and this is kind of like the conveyance of the Harambe School to the Roseville School District, because these two buildings are actually located in the two member school districts. And just out of respect for your time, I think I will dispense with the section-by-section walkthrough of the bill, since I know you all have it in front of you, except to mention that contrary to the previous bill, the fiscal note to this bill shows no general fund cost for the K-12 finance school transition language. With that, I'll turn it over to my testifiers, I have instructed to keep it very brief.
Thank you, Representative Freiberg. We appreciate that. Welcome.
Chair Loon and members of the committee and Representative Freiberg, my name is Keith Lester. I'm superintendent of the West Metro Education Program, or WEMEP, and I appreciate this opportunity to speak on behalf of House File 1248. I'll try to really be brief. 20 years ago when the school started, there was a need for integration between Minneapolis, which was racially isolated, and the member districts, the 11 member districts, which were primarily the western suburbs, which were not diverse, were primarily white. So there was this need for that kind of integration. So the two schools were started at the same time, or about the same time, we were operating professional development programming and student programming with the idea of providing integration and opportunity and educational opportunity, if you will, closing the gap, if I can use that term. So all of these things were happening at the same time. The reality is that members of the member districts of our consortium or our collaborative now are as or more diverse than Minneapolis, and so the needs for the integration is between the districts and within the districts even. So the need for the schools is not what it was 20 years ago. So that's one of the main drivers for this as we go along. For years they talked about should we be running the schools, and I can recall I went to Brooklyn Center in 2005 as superintendent, and they were talking about it then, because in Brooklyn Center is a good example of the diversity. You know, is this the way to deal with integration? Well, you have recently passed a new bill or a new law which says that we are about integration, but we're also about closing the gap. We're about student achievement. And we feel that this conveyance would benefit in both ways very strongly. And you can wonder about that a little bit, other than to say that we're limited. We can't levy. And so we have resources, or actually the other districts have resources, that we can't access. So we think, because they will remain integration schools, and it's in the law, that will actually strengthen those schools because of the resources that will be added to it. And at the same time, we're going to take a high-quality professional development program, and we're going to take it to new levels. And I'd be happy to share that with any of you who are interested. Representative Mariani has seen pieces of it. And it's going to be, a state-of-the-art professional development program, which will impact teachers, which will impact students. There are 100,000 students in the West Metro Education, actually 112,000 in West Metro Education Program schools. The two schools we're talking about, total enrollment is 940. So we will impact more kids at a higher level, and we will address closing the gap. We will address achievement at a much higher level for all students. You heard, I won't get into, we've had numerous meetings. We've had great support. But I want to just say that we have a plan. It's a plan to convey the schools confident in the potential for maintaining and enhancing what is good about them, as I said, a plan to seek and build and strengthen the quality work begun in supporting all of our young people in all of our member districts through the professional development and quality student programming. All of this will be based on equity, integration, cultural competence, and student achievement. So I urge you to support this bill so that we can continue moving in this direction on behalf of WEMAP member districts, their children, and their families. Thank you.
Thank you. Welcome.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Aldo Ciccoli, Superintendent of Robbinsdale Area Schools. Thanks for providing the opportunity to testify in support of House File 1248. Robbinsdale Area Schools enthusiastically embraces the continuation of an integration arts magnet at the Fair Crystal School, which enrolls students from WEMAP member districts and other school districts, and it does reside on our school district property. We're committed to working with Minneapolis Public Schools to create a sustainable kindergarten through grade 12 configuration. Our school district has a strategic plan focused on equity and student achievement and a proud tradition in the arts, so we feel like we're well suited to build upon the excellence at the Fair Crystal School. And we want to do whatever we can to provide a soft landing for the staff and the students at Fair Crystal. Right now, there's students in grades 4 to 8 at that site, so students entering fourth grade next year will be able to continue through eighth grade as we work with Minneapolis to ensure a K-12 integration magnet with an arts focus. We're encouraging Fair Crystal staff to stay in their current positions if they want to do so, and I think they've had 30 days to consider that, and tomorrow, I think, is the deadline to inform us. We want to continue the many valuable partnerships the school has. The lottery for next year's enrollment has already occurred, and there's plans to continue that into the future. We also want to do what we can to strengthen this tremendous school, as Superintendent Lester alluded to. So we're prepared to add two additional positions for next school year, an equity specialist position and an instructional coach position. We also have a talented teaching and learning department that can assist in developing, enriching, and aligning curriculum. So Robbinsdale Area Schools values this partnership with WEMAP school districts and looks forward to expanding the exceptional professional development and student programs that WEMAP currently offers. We're confident that we will do well in educating Fair students as WEMAP focuses on the other important areas of its mission. So please support this bill so we can move forward seamlessly in serving the families of the 11 member WEMAP school districts. Yeah.
Thank you. Welcome.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Steve Liss. I'm general counsel for the Minneapolis Public Schools. And thank you for the opportunity to be here, and we ask for your support. Minneapolis is excited about the opportunity to assume leadership for the Downtown Fair School. We share WEMAP's commitment to integration and to the arts, and think we can build on the exemplary success of the school. We've been working with the Fair Downtown School staff and parents to make the transition as smooth as possible. Tomorrow is the deadline that we expect to hear from our staff, and we hope that we will retain as many of the staff in their positions as possible. We've already hired the current principal at the downtown school to continue on as the principal of the new downtown school. Our superintendent has met with staff and families to answer questions and to explain our district's commitment. We've also had additional meetings with individual staff members to explain the situation, explain the transition. We've gone beyond, there's certain statutory requirements for the transition. We've gone beyond those to make sure that we have as smooth a transition as possible and are as welcoming as possible to the staff that's there. We also, Minneapolis does share the commitment to continue with WEMAP's good work. I think we all, the 11 districts, collectively feel that by transitioning out of the running the schools, WEMAP can continue to a much stronger future and really serve effectively the 100,000 students in the metro, in the West Metropolitan area. We've also had the opportunity to build on the partnership with Robbinsdale. The current configuration, downtown serves K-3, Robbinsdale serves 4-8, and we serve the 9-12 students. We've talked about different arrangements that maybe make a little more sense to the students, but we are collectively committed to continuing an integrated K-12 program between Robbinsdale and Minneapolis. We currently have strong relationships with downtown arts and cultural organizations, as does the downtown school, and we feel we can build on those partnerships, improve the relationships, and provide additional opportunities for our students. And while we continue the unique opportunity that exists at FAIR to bring together students from the entire West Metro area. Again, thank you for your support on this bill.
Thank you. Any questions from committee members? Representative Mariani.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Very quickly, I know we're running out of time here. So last couple of years, we had a similar situation with the East Metro Integration District and their two schools, and you referenced that in your testimony earlier. One of the issues that we were concerned with, however, at that point was had to do with the mission of those schools being able to continue within, you know, the state's investment in integration work. And so we definitely hear a message about, you know, it's 2015, you know, it's a whole different, you know, demographics. You know, there's some great opportunities to impact 120,000 students in a different way. But what about these schools? Would the expectation be that these two schools, after convey, will continue to have at least a part of their work to be about integration opportunities?
I can just answer that real briefly, and then thank you, Madam Chair. My apologies, Madam Chair, Representative Mariani. If you look at the bill language, it does specify on line 114-15 that the downtown school has to be operated as a multi-district integration facility. Line 1.23-24, it specifies that the Crystal School has to be operated as a multi-district integration facility. I don't know if the testifiers have any follow-up on that, but just thought I'd mention that at the outset.
Madam Chair, that's important because of the fact that we invested as a state in these facilities for that purpose. And so I think it's really important that we maintain that purpose going forward, obviously under a different delivery system and set of arrangements, but still with the same mission and purpose.
Thank you. Other questions? All right. Is there anyone else from the general public who wishes to testify on the bill? Not seeing any. All right. Representative Freiberg, anything else you want to add?
Thank you very much for hearing the bill, Madam Chair.
All right. So with that, I renew my motion and House File 1248 be referred to the Capital Investment Committee. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? All right. It's approved. It's on its way to Capital Investment. Members, just as a reminder, a couple of things. One, we are going to be having a hearing tomorrow. We've got a few more bills that we're trying to get heard. So we will be meeting in room 10 at 11:30. And I am asking everyone who's on the list, and I've had a couple of other requests today, we will try to accommodate as many as we can. But I'm asking you to try to keep your number of testifiers down, and I will be uncharacteristically strict about time tomorrow, just because we've got a lot of work to do in trying to prepare the omnibus bill. On the omnibus bill front, we are going to be working on that bill next week. My plan at this point is to have it available for the committee hopefully Tuesday morning, and that our plan would be then to do a walkthrough of the bill on Tuesday next week, taking public testimony on Wednesday, and amendment and consideration of the bill on Thursday, with completion of the bill on Thursday. So that's our schedule as it looks right now. And if you have any questions, you have any questions about that right now, Representative Murphy, or if you want to talk to me offline, that would be fine as well.
Madam Chair, when you say available on Tuesday morning, I know that you can't say it's time certain, but are you talking about before the meeting?
Yes. At
12:30?
Yes, before the meeting. You know, if it's ready earlier, I'll post it as soon as it's ready. But I'm hoping that obviously we'll be able to post it Tuesday morning, so members would have a chance to look through it, and then we'll spend Tuesday's committee doing a walkthrough with explanation by nonpartisan staff.
And then, Madam Chair, is it your intent that we would take things out, or would we put things in? Is the document that you're going to show us, that's going to be available for us on Tuesday morning for the walkthrough on Tuesday afternoon at the regularly scheduled meeting?
Correct.
Is that the document then, or is everything that has a possibility of being in there going to be in there, or is it going to be front end loaded and then it's up to us to take things out?
Well, it'll be a delete all amendment we'll use House File 844 as our bill, as our plan right now. I'll have a delete all amendment, so this will be the bill that I'm working on, and then we'll go through it so everybody understands what's in it on Tuesday's committee hearing. Wednesday, members of the public will be able to offer their comments on it, and then Thursday will be the committee opportunity for members to offer amendments if you wish to delete things or add things. We will do that on Thursday.
Through amendments.
Correct.
Madam Chair. And the amendments will be due on Wednesday.
Wednesday.
Madam Chair, will the bill that is available for our perusal on Tuesday morning will it balance with the amount that was in your target?
Yes, Representative Murphy.
And, Madam Chair, is there any between now and Tuesday when the bill is going to be revealed, are you intending to meet to discuss priorities?
As a full committee or?
No, with individuals or the minority?
Yes. I think you and I will have another sit down, and I will talk to you about that as soon as we gavel out about our schedules. And then obviously, you know, I've always invited committee members to share with me their priorities, and some of the bills we're hearing are trying to get as many of the ideas and priorities of members before the committee, before we get down to getting the delete all put together.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Any other questions from committee members? All right. With that, we are adjourned for today. Thank you, members. I'll see you tomorrow at 11:30, room 10.